Welcome to another Kundalini After Dark session. I'm your host, Brent Spirit. I'm here in the Zoom room with 24 others. We got a few tuning in on YouTube. Thank you all so much for joining me live tonight. If you're listening to the recording in the archive, you can join the next Kundalini After Dark meeting. That link is in the description. We'd love to have you. Thank you all so much for your support. For all those that have offered a donation, it really means a lot. I appreciate it. As well, for those that have offered any engagement online, leaving a review on Spotify, liking, subscribing, commenting, all of that goes a long, long way. I really am thankful. So tonight I'm going to ramble a little bit about some things on my mind, and then I'm going to open the floor up for others to share as well. We'll get some discussion going on audio, on video. I'll also read whatever you have to share in the chat as best as I can, but I'm going to prioritize those on audio or video. Can ask some questions to the group. You can respond to questions to the group. You can vent. You can celebrate. You can share some resources. You can laugh. We can cry. Whatever comes up, it's all welcome here. Please know that we're not here to discuss any medical advice. Our meeting tonight is not a substitute for counseling or psychotherapy. We're meeting as lay people on the internet to have a spiritually oriented conversation for education, for entertainment, for spiritual growth. So, some interesting things have unfolded recently for me in my life. The other day, I was listening to an interview on a fantastic YouTube channel, the fantastic host, Guru Viking. Check it out, some really brilliant interviews. I think he may be the best interviewer on YouTube, perhaps in the world. Incredibly skilled, but also just has the most incredible guests, and he gets them to share some really profound, far out stuff to do with the spiritual path. I haven't been in touch with him. I just really love his channel. Check it out. Anyway, I was listening to one of his interviews, and somebody had mentioned that they came across a very, dedicated meditator, an advanced meditator, very advanced person on the spiritual path, and they had a statue of the Buddha. And this person had described that that statue and the Buddha are the same. They're one and the same. And when I heard this, it really just kind of stuck with me. The statue and the Buddha are not different, right? Not just a symbol, not just a representation, but actually the statue is the Buddha. I thought, wow, this is powerful. Something about that really hit me. Anyway, that was a few days ago. Just yesterday, I'm on Facebook Marketplace. And I am browsing some used items being listed. I have a bit of a hobby addiction. I love vintage hi-fi audio equipment. So I look for old rare speakers and whatnot and have some fun with that. That's what keeps me grounded a little bit materialistic. When I miss a deal, I get upset. So it's a fun bit of gambling. If you see behind me, I don't know if you can see, but I've got some Braun stereo equipment designed by the great designer Dieter Rams, who was the inspiration behind Apple's design. So I like to collect things like this. Anyway, I'm browsing the ads on Facebook and I see a life-size statue of the Buddha. Gold plated, and somebody is selling it for what seems to me to be a very cheap price. So I start doing some Googling about this, and I see that this is a rare piece, very rare. So it's a Burmese statue of the Buddha. Burma, of course, I believe is now Myanmar. Anyway, I contacted this seller, and now I am in possession of a life-size gold plated Buddha statue. It seems to be no different than the Buddha. So this was an interesting unfolding. While I have this Buddha statue laying flat in the back of my car, I'm driving down, I'm listening to Abraham Hicks. If you're familiar with Abraham Hicks, Law of Attraction teachings, brilliant, incredible, love it. They're telling a story that describe that Esther Hicks is telling a story. She said that she accidentally caused one of her shelves to collapse, and a bunch of her treasures fell, and some of them broke. And one of them was a statue of Kuan Yin, which is another Buddhist figure, right? A bodhisattva, Kuan Yin. And this statue of Kuan Yin completely crumbled and shattered. And they were describing, impermanence. He said, oh, it's destroyed. Great. We get to go on an adventure and find a replacement, more things to buy. So that's Abraham Hicks' attitude. This is their teachings. You know, we go with the flow and whatever. So eventually she describes that she made her way over to a gift shop, some arts shop or something like that. And in the back office, she finds the same statue that she'd been looking for years to replace it for years. And she says, I want that. You have to give it to me. You have to sell it to me. And the owner said, no, it's not for sale. It's not for sale. Eventually, through the flow, through some magic, through some synchronicity, the owner, of course, sells it to her. And she, acquires this statue of Kuan Yin. So I found that to be very fitting while I'm driving with the Buddha statue in my trunk. I'm listening to Abraham Hicks talk about a bodhisattva statue as well. So anyway, Burmese, there is a particular meditation style, Vipassana, which is a Buddhist meditation style, is, you know, quite popular in Burma. And the other day, someone had on the community calls was describing attending a Vipassana meditation retreat. Most popular, at least in the West, are taught by SN Goenka, right? Maybe you've heard of these 10-day Vipassana meditation retreats, silent, free. They operate on donations. And so they teach this Buddhist meditation style in a secular manner, though, of course, there are very strong Buddhist overtones. And so in this retreat, they practice Vipassana. Vipassana means observing reality as it is. But there's no description of this process of called Kundalini. There's no description of energy moving through the body, of chakras. There's no description of any of this. And yet so many people participate in these retreats and begin to have very profound awakening processes with all sorts of the typical energetic phenomena that we are so familiar with, you know, energy rising up the spine, spontaneous movements, kriyas, all sorts of mystical and non-ordinary phenomena can begin to arise. Now, some people who attend a Vipassana retreat, they don't have any of this, while others do. Now, unfortunately, those who begin to have these experiences, they may turn to the teacher at the Vipassana retreat and they say, I just had this energy explode up my spine, or I can't sit still. I'm moving spontaneously. What is happening to me? And the teacher may not be equipped to say, oh, this is Kundalini. Sometimes the teacher says, no, you have to try and sit still, stop moving. Sit still. So they aren't often even open to acknowledging what is happening with these, you know, profound energetic openings, right? So that's the unfortunate part of some of these retreats. They're not equipped to support those that are struggling with spontaneous, dare I say, spontaneous Kundalini awakenings. However, I did come across something very interesting in Shinzen Young's book here. This is a perfect book. It's called The Science of Enlightenment. I hope you can see it. Shinzen Young, The Science of Enlightenment. Shinzen Young is an absolutely phenomenal teacher of meditation, of mindfulness. Really brilliant. I highly encourage you to check out his work. He's just a total nerd and just a pleasure to listen to. This book, like I said, I really mean it. It's a perfect book. Absolutely love it. If you haven't begun meditating, this could be a great way to begin. If you have been meditating and you would like to maybe take your practice to the next level or feel re-inspired to go deeper with your practice, it's a great book, The Science of Enlightenment. So in this book, it's not a Kundalini book, just like those Vipassana meditation retreats are not a Kundalini meditation retreat or practice. However, there is a mention of Kundalini in this book here. And so I'll read briefly here. So he's speaking about impermanence. And so if you're familiar with Buddhism, this is one of the core insights in Buddhism, which is that, you know, everything is impermanent. Everything is constantly changing. And so this may be one of the few things we can say we know for sure. Change is the only constant. It's undeniable. right? And so when we think of impermanence in the broader scope, we think of, you know, death, we think of decay, we think of maybe people coming and going in our lives, phases and whatnot. That's impermanence, of course. But then there's impermanence on the more micro level compared to the macro, you know, like I said, life, death, transition, seasons, etc. And there's impermanence on the micro level. Moment to moment, there are these experiences of change that if we are subtle enough with our attention and our focus and our concentration, we can tune in and we can perceive it directly. When we perceive it directly, it can be a great way to move through suffering or uncomfortable emotions, sensations, experiences in the body, in the mind. It can be a great way to enter into the flow and live without clinging, without pushing away, without attachment, right? Just totally in the present moment in a very, very heightened, hyper-focused way. So he has a whole chapter on the different ways that impermanence shows up in the world. And I think it's called The Different Masks of Impermanence, The Many Faces of Impermanence. But this brief paragraph here is pretty powerful. So once we get into impermanence as a pleasant flow of energy, he describes it as a smooth, effortless effervescence that's nurturing and enlivening. So in meditation, you can begin to experience this type of thing. He says, at this point, we are on the edge of an important transition because now we can yield to the flow and let it meditate us. The perception I am meditating fades into the background as and is replaced by the perception that impermanence is meditating me. You think of impermanence in this guise as your helper in meditation. The great Burmese master, Uba Khin, who was, if I'm not mistaken, S.N. Goenka's teacher. The great Burmese master, Uba Khin, had an interesting and useful way of talking about impermanence, which I am sure was never used in earlier Buddhism. He spoke of activating impermanence. At some point, you may experience impermanence as a kind of energy that has been activated within you and helps you along with the meditation. It is a kind of impermanence you can ride and surf. In Hindu meditation, this is sometimes called Kundalini or Shakti. So these ideas here, impermanence is meditating me, sounds very familiar, right? Sometimes we say, Shakti is moving me. Shakti is performing kriyas upon me, right? Shakti is drawing me spontaneously into meditation. So Kundalini Shakti and this notion of impermanence are not different, are not different. This is what I've come to understand. This is why you may look towards some of the Buddhist traditions, for example, on a Vipassana retreat, and you wonder why they're not talking about Kundalini Shakti. In a sense, they are. They're talking about impermanence. They're just not using the personified, anthropomorphized, if that's the word, anthropomorphic language of the Divine Mother. They're just referring to this flow of impermanence, right? So we can tap into this on the micro level, like I said, of course, life, death, seasons, time is passing by, whatever. But then there's the micro level experience where you can recognize the flow of energy through your body. Maybe it has some connection with your breath. You can recognize that the inhale and the exhale are not two. It is just the constant change of the breath. And we come in with the mind and we categorize each section of the breath as inhale and exhale, but really it's just one thing changing, flowing, oscillating, something like this. Even right now, you may see my mouth is moving, my head's moving a little bit. You can note the change that's happening on the micro level, right? I'm speaking, you can hear that there are changes in the vibrations and the sound waves that are coming from your speakers. You can note this on a very micro level. You can note it in your body as well. Subtle pain, subtle sensations may be coming, going, becoming more heightened, passing away, changing, right? So we can move into this. And if we move into this type of hyper-focused awareness, then we're totally in the flow. Then we are moving in a state of oneness right? Because the distinction between this and that falls away. We see it's all just constantly changing. And this is the direction that I feel this Kundalini process is taking us in. It's just to merge into it, the state of impermanence without attachment, without clinging, right? So this is the same as enlightenment in Buddhism. When I began to realize this, what I found was an easy doorway into it was, like I said, to note any visual changes around me. And just to note the subtle changes in the lighting and the shadows. If you're watching a movie or something, then it's very obvious. There's lots of changes on the screen. But noting any subtle changes, right? Noting any subtle changes. If you listen to music, so in the macro level, we can say there's music playing. When the playlist ends, the music is stopped. That's change, right? Then we can go deeper. We could say there's a song that has now changed into a different song and then a different song. That's a degree of change as well. Then we can say within a song, first it's the intro, then it's the verse, then it's the chorus, then it's the verse, then it's the bridge, whatever. But we can also recognize on the micro level, we can note the subtleties of when sounds are emerging out of the silence and then returning back into the silence. We can note the changes in pitch, the changes in volume. We can note these changes, and we don't have to label it in our mind by saying, oh, louder, softer, high pitch, low pitch. We can just become aware of those changes. And what happens is that your consciousness begins to just become very fluid with all of the changes. And it's like you begin to merge with the music, with the visuals that are changing, and you recognize that it's all oneness. It's all oneness. Of course, this takes some practice for some. Maybe perhaps you can just slip right in. But it's something very interesting and something that has really changed my practice, my understanding of this path. And I love to practice Vipassana for this reason. So those are some ideas to explore. I have a full-length talk where I go a little bit more into this called Kundalini and Impermanence, something like that. You can find it. I talk about my trip to California, to Yosemite, where this dawned on me in a really, really beautiful way. So I'm curious if others have any thoughts on what I've shared. I'll open the floor up for others to share about their experiences. You can visit kundaliniawareness.org, where we have a directory of licensed mental health professionals with Kundalini awakening experience. I don't get any money from that or anything. It's really just to raise awareness and to offer support for those that are going through this process. So hopefully maybe you know, you can find a therapist that's nearby. Maybe your insurance will pay for it, and you can be well on your way. So I'm going to pause there. I'm going to open the floor up now for others to share what's on your mind. We can go off topic. It doesn't have to be related to what I've shared today. If you have some questions for myself or the group, if you have some answers, all is welcome. All is welcome. Let's see what's coming up for others. Tani shares the Buddha and the statue, the same. Amen. Amen. The truest truth. Yes. There's a section in Shinzen Young's book. He describes, let me see here. So really, yeah, it's called The Stone Buddha Dances. The Stone Buddha Dances. Right, so when we're tuned into impermanence, we see that even the stones are dancing, and the stone Buddha is dancing, flowing, changing, impermanence. Protagonist on YouTube shares here, hello. I've been meditating on and off for about 8 months now, and I've just started to experience tremors slash shaking during meditations since about 1 month ago. Does this have to do with Kundalini? I've also noticed my hands opening and closing by themselves during the meditations. Anyhow, I appreciate your insights. Great. So if others have some insights for protagonists, please let us know. But to me, this sounds like it definitely has to do with Kundalini. Right. So some will describe shaking, vibrating. Sometimes it gets a little bit more intense. You may describe it maybe as convulsion, these types of things. As the Kundalini begins to move through the system, it can cause these spontaneous movements. They can be very subtle vibrations. For example, I had a very subtle one, which was just my teeth kind of chattering, kind of like a shiver, but very subtle. I had to tune in really closely to perceive that very subtle. Now, other times it's been like full blown, like shaking somewhat violently while lying down, for example. I'm sure others can relate to all of this. The hands opening and closing by themselves during the meditations. Very interesting. That sounds like it could be either some mudras, if you were to pay attention to the actual specific formations of your hands opening and closing, it could be related to some mudras, which are various hand gestures. Like you may see, for example, the Buddha engaging in different hand gestures, even Jesus, depictions of Jesus, he's engaging in these mudras. Maybe perhaps this is just the beginning of a more sophisticated unfolding of spontaneous movements with your hands. So in the beginning, it may be just opening and closing. Maybe as time progresses, you relax, your process continues to unfold. People begin to engage in all sorts of very beautiful mudras with the hands. They look very similar to, say, traditional like Indian dance, for example, which I'm sure is inspired by these spontaneous mudras, Indian dance. It's never happened to me, the spontaneous mudras, but I know for others, it just begins to happen in very, very interesting ways. Yeah, maybe some others have some thoughts, some things to share. Lacey shares here, my body moves while meditating. Anything from tingles to tense movements. My breath changes. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. The breath as well, right? Spontaneous pranayama. We begin to be meditated, moved, breathed by the flow of impermanence within us, by the Shakti within us, right? We can just ride it, just ride it. Walk on water shares here. It's all an energy exchange. In this case, in a vibrational frequency. This is an effect of the reciprocal relationship of yin and yang, of rotational motion on a scalar level. Example, macro and micro. Very well said. All right, then. So we're going to go over to our friend Nick B. Nick Breathor has been part of this community for some time, and he has published a book titled The Saffron Tiger, Kundalini Awakening, Carl Jung, and the DMT Mystery. It's on sale now. I'm sure you can find it with a quick Google, but I invite you to check it out. The Saffron Tiger is a unique and vivid firsthand account of an unprepared Kundalini awakening, the ultimate goal of yoga. It stands out by exploring the stages of the evolution of consciousness embedded in the allegories of classic mythology and weaving them into a true story of self-realization in a modern setting. So, Nick and I will be having a full conversation on the channel about his journey and his work. You can look forward to that. First, I've got to, of course, read this book. I've just been a little busy, but Nick has been so kind to provide me with an opportunity to read it. So I look forward to that. I invite you to check it out. And let's hear from Nick. Nick, talk to us a bit about this book. Congratulations.
Thanks, Brent. Yeah, so I've been going through the Kundalini journey like for about 5 years now, more or less exactly. In November of 2019, I was meditating, and I'd had a spiritual emergency in 2016, didn't really understand what had happened to me, but it had essentially primed Kundalini to awaken quite quickly in me after engaging in some transcendental meditation. So I experienced like a top-down Kundalini awakening. It was very extreme and fast. And a few months after it began, I just felt compelled to start writing and exploring different subjects. Started as a journal that I was just going to keep to myself. That was essentially helping me process each stage of, peeling away the layers and integrating higher levels of perception. And then so I just started reading a lot of Carl Jung's works. I picked up his book, The Red Book, and that was a book that remained unpublished until 2009. His family kept it secret, and he wanted to keep it secret. But it really describes his journey through, an experience of spiritual emergency and divine madness, and this catalyzing Kundalini to awaken. I just found myself in that book. I found his explanations symbolically of these different stages of the journey transposing into my life as I was reading it. So it was this guide, and it was a very obscure book, but I felt like I could understand it. And so I just started writing about it and studying other myths, including Shiva and Shakti's story and the Vijnan Bhairav Tantra, that original conversation between them and the 112 methods of meditation that Shiva gives to Shakti, and then other myths like King Midas and Oedipus, the myth about Inanna's descent to the underworld, the goddess, and the seven stages of descent to the underworld she goes through. And so yeah, I started to kind of fall in love with writing and exploring all these subjects more and more. And I just noticed the more I would write, the more it would help the process of alchemy to unfold within me, and it helped to accelerate the journey as I essentially created, an intellectual structure around the chaos of the Kundalini that was arising out of me. And it wasn't until recently that I discovered really the true meaning of the book. I was reading, because the saffron tiger is a symbolic idea of, or symbolic representation of the goddess Durga, who is a very powerful entity that kind of helped support my journey. And then the color saffron is actually, I was just reading Psychology and Alchemy by Carl Jung recently, and there's a alchemist from Belgium named Gerard Dorn. He's like a 16th century alchemist, but he wrote about the color saffron representing this process that he described called the spagyric opus, which essentially means in alchemy breaking down the parts of a mixture into individual components and then recombining them. And that's essentially the task that we're given when we go through an alchemical cycle, which we go through repeatedly on the Kundalini path. So saffron is the symbolic color of that. And so it just made me realize that the book to me was really about breaking down all the parts of myself, understanding them, and then recombining them. And yeah, I think it's just an interesting firsthand account that dives into a lot of that relates to a lot of very powerful and historical mythological motifs and storylines and integrates them into my story. So I think for a reader who's going through Kundalini, they can also project themselves into these myths as I'm going through them and into the stages of the journey as well, and help them to understand, what's going on here from an archetypal perspective, like these powerful forces that are pushing us along this journey and how they were described in mythology and itemized in mythology. And yeah, so I hope people enjoy it. You can find it on Amazon in paperback, and you can find it on my website, evltn.co.co. You can find the ebook on my website. So I'll post some links in the chat.
Please.
So yeah, if you have any more questions, but happy to discuss it some more.
Yeah, great. Thank you so much, Nick. I'm looking forward to diving in, and like I said, we're gonna talk more in a full podcast about it. You mentioned transcendental meditation had sort of triggered this awakening. I'm curious. The TM people do sometimes speak about Kundalini a little bit more than the Vipassana people, as from what I understand. Did you find support within that community?
I didn't actually learn it from them. I found it's a very, they keep it very secretive and they make you pay for it. And I ended up just finding a guide that was maybe an incorrect or a correct interpretation of the technique online. But I kind of added my own kind of, not my own, but a different, I kind of mixed it together with, I guess, meditating on the third eye and I guess Japanese meditation, where I was, which I guess is TM, where you're imagining the sound of a mantra internally. And I just made up my own mantra, to be honest. I just had intuitively came up with a very simple mantra, the sound like Rin, just RN. I just imagined that sound. It was just very easy to imagine on my third eye and silently. And yeah, I just noticed very strange effects happening to me physically, pulses of energy starting to radiate through my body. yeah, just very strange phenomenon started to occur after only several hours of meditation. And then I experienced the Kundalini enter through the seventh chakra first and through my head and through the third eye right away. I think that the experience that I had previously with a spiritual emergency like cleared those chakras open for some reason. And so yeah, it was kind of like a modified kind of TM slash maybe Kundalini yoga meditation. And it was very powerful.
Amazing,
Yeah.
amazing. And Galen types here in the chat, Rin is an abbreviation for right now. Love the symbolism, whether
Yeah,
intentional or not.
totally. And also, right before I awakened, I had like a, because I was meditating like probably 15 minutes at a time, like on a regular basis for a few months. And then that night when Kundalini awakened, I just was in meditation, and then I heard a voice just say to me, like, keep going, go deeper. And I ended up meditating for like a full hour or an hour and a half, and I just kept going deeper and deeper. And then it rose. It came from above, like descent of grace style, but it also raised from the bottom at the same time. But it definitely wasn't a complete, full and complete awakening by any means. But it definitely triggered the process to unfold over 5 years. So I feel like it's taken a while. But I like back to the Buddhist thing. Like I wanted to comment on that. Like I've no like negative. Not saying anything negative about Buddhism. Like Buddha's obviously an amazing avatar and representation of the divine. But I find like that I've interacted with some Buddhists. The ones that I've interacted with, a few of them, they don't seem to hold space for the chaos of awakening and spiritual emergency and all these things that people go through on their awakening journey. At least the people that I, and maybe it's just these individuals, but they seem to think, and that they're not awakened, these people. And so I guess they seem to think you can just become enlightened without any sort of crisis or what. I guess it's maybe project in their minds, it becomes this elitist kind of very smooth process that's not supposed to be challenging, at least to the one or two people that I've met. Not to cast any, I love the Buddhist teachings. But I mean, it takes me back to the Buddhist story of the Buddha when he, right before he attains enlightenment, he's attacked by a bunch of demons. And so to me, that to me is like a spiritual emergency, probably. When we start to expand those higher divine energies, the opposite kind of darkness and demonic forces try to like pull us down and take us out, essentially, and we have to be able to navigate that. So
Yeah, I think it might also be a scaling problem, right? Some would say, there's different approaches, of course. There's different paths of Buddhism, Mahayana, Vajrayana, for example, right? There's the great vehicle to take as many people towards enlightenment as possible. And so if we're scaling to this huge degree, yeah, maybe there isn't enough consideration for the uniqueness of each person's development, their experiences, and that sort of thing, so that it's just almost overlooked in a sense. Maybe that's just something that's coming to me. I'm sure there are some Buddhist scholars out there that could pick apart what I just said quite well. But I've noticed that some of this, at least what I see, it could be a scaling problem, like a business.
And I mean, people want to sell books too, and I think that if you talk about how difficult it is if you were to encounter Kundalini firsthand, it's maybe not as alluring, because it is life-changing and extremely challenging. And I think everyone in this group understands that who's been through Kundalini. It's like not a joke, and it's not easy. Yeah, it's very, very tough. So.
Every now and then I'll get people that come across my work and they may send me an email or something saying, I would like to have my Kundalini awakened. What do I do? And I always just say, like, I don't, that's not something I offer. I have like enough people that have had their Kundalini awakened by some means, and they're like, their life is turned upside down. I'm here to support them. I'm not here to show you how to awaken your Kundalini because you don't know what this is. And it's like, it's very, very intense. I'm not rude to them. I give them some general support and practices and things to consider and whatnot, and for some resources and whatnot. But yeah, this is no joke. No joke at all. Yeah.
Yeah. So I suppose the Buddhist way is essentially like a gentle and slow path towards enlightenment. It's definitely not a provocative one, and it's the smart way probably to do it, but I think it just happens spontaneously in a lot of us,
Yeah.
and we have to become the warrior to essentially get through it.
Yeah. And there's what's the website? Cheetah House. Cheetah House. So their focus is on helping people to manage the adverse effects of meditation, right? For example, like what you just described, some may say that you experience an adverse effect of meditation. Spiritual emergency, energy, all these types of things. So Willoughby Britton had spoken to the Dalai Lama, and I'm gonna probably paraphrase and probably be a little bit inaccurate, so forgive me. But she basically asked, like people are meditating and they're having all these challenging experiences. And the Dalai Lama's response was, who told them to meditate? Who told them? Right? Nobody told you to start meditating. And if you look into some of these traditions in Buddhism, like they don't just take somebody and say, oh, you want to get enlightened? All right, come and sit, start meditating. No, you have to like study, you have to be in a community. You develop relationships with the teachers. All these types of things are built into the tradition so that when you do begin to practice very intensely and these things happen, then you're able to manage it, or you know who to turn to, or whatnot, right? Whereas here, like myself, we just sit down and start practicing and all these things happen, and now we have to figure it out, right? So it's very, very interesting. Well, thank you so much, Nick. Vicky shares here that your book sounds amazing and she's just ordered it. Great.
Okay,
Great.
thanks a lot, Vicky. Appreciate it.
So Tom shares here in the chat, follow the sound of the breath as it is drawn in and pushed out. Follow it to the place where it stops on the inside, in the heart, about 4 finger breaths down from the sternoclavicular notch. Pay attention to the pause where the breath stops. When the breath stops, the mind also stops, and one becomes aware without thoughts. Do the same when you exhale and find that place on the outside. That place, inside and outside, are the same. Awareness, free from thoughts. Find yourself there. Very powerful, very clear. Thank you for sharing that, Tom. Sounds like a complete practice that perhaps can take you all the way. Taze shares here, can you guys explain more about the demons attack during the expansion of consciousness? I think I had these demons attack and I never understood why. One of the attacks made me very weak and no energy to get out of bed. The guidance I received was I had to fight them, and I did. Very challenging, somewhat spooky, Taze. Well, like Nick was sharing, Nick, maybe you have some more comments on this, but this reminds you of the Buddha sitting down under the Bodhi tree, right? And then being tempted by the demon Mara, right? So even the Buddha was, under attack by demons on his journey towards enlightenment, or in your words, Taze, the expansion of consciousness, right? He didn't give in to the temptation. He just kept sitting. Whereas Taze, you're sharing here that you had to fight them. And any thoughts coming to you, Nick, about that?
Yeah, to me, I look at it kind of archetypally, like the demonic archetype is like the mirror image of the divine. And when we're on this journey, we have to integrate the demonic archetype in a sense, like all of the dark and evil aspects of our potential human consciousness have to be understood and integrated in order for us to move to another level or to a higher level of consciousness. We can't move to a higher level of consciousness without understanding those things because we'll be susceptible in some way to things like ego inflation. Like if you look at the archetype of the fallen angel in Christianity, that's essentially an angel that thinks of itself as being on par with God, and then it gets banished to hell. And it's essentially that's the story of Lucifer. And that plays out in humanity in the sense of like ego inflation. We become too big for ourselves, and we are triggering a fall into the dark side to essentially go through a psychic restructuring and to learn certain lessons. So when we encounter the demonic archetype on the spiritual path, I think it's initiatory. So it's going to teach us something, and it's something we have to integrate and understand. We don't want to become possessed by it. So there has to be like a division between the ego and the demonic archetype, just like there has to be a division between the ego and the divine too. Like we don't want to be consumed by these things. We want to create a barrier between them, between us and them. We want to understand them, and we want to integrate the lessons. So that's how I look at it. A friend of mine and I were talking about this a lot lately, how there's a very strong initiatory element to what we call the demonic, but that's just an image that represents a certain dimension of energy. You know, our consciousness produces an image of a god or an image of a demon. It represents some dimension of consciousness. Tends to be a dark part of it and something we want to avoid typically, but in the spiritual process, we can't avoid it. So we have to face it, we have to integrate it and understand it. That's how I look at it.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Yeah, I agree. So for me, when I think of this idea of integrating these elements, to me, it was offering them love, which meant seeing them as not separate, aka reintegrating them back into the oneness. So that took so much of commitment to love on my part, because I also, like Taze, experienced what we may call demonic attacks and whatnot. And in the beginning, very scary, but then eventually I had to remember, wait, hold on, hold on. This is something I have to love. And so I just said, I love you, and caught myself becoming afraid and just said, no, I love you. The power of love is stronger than the power of fear or darkness or whatever it is, love and light, you know. And it seemed to pacify these demons. It seemed to be what I needed to do to overcome this part. But there were some times where I also was found, particularly in sort of lucid spiritual dreams, where I, like Taze is describing here, I had to fight them. And for me, the fight was me having a spine and standing up and enforcing boundaries, recognizing that, you know, like Kali, she fights demons, beheads them, right? This is also part of it as well, to a degree.
When I began to, when I first received Shaktipat, and I began to have episodes in which, in meditation, where I would be, go to appear in places that I'd known where a lot of like bad things had happened, like places where a lot of drug dealing and stuff took place and such, and there was one particular that stands out. There was a sort of a hole in the wall, kind of a dump, and I appeared there in meditation, and there was like almost like a black smoke coming out of it, and I could there was a shimmering there of power, of energy that was evil, that was. Then I looked, but I knew I had to do something about that. And I looked around and, or somehow saw and sensed that I was in the company of a legion of beings. Some took forms of dogs, some of lions and tigers. And anyway, suddenly all those beings attacked that place. And I ran. I could said I can't let them fight alone. So I ran with them, and I was knocked down by a huge white lion that had its paw on my chest, and it said, "No, this is what we do." And then rushed forward again, and purified that entire place. Just took all the evil out of, destroyed it, or dissolved it, or whatever happens. Which is sort of a interest when it comes to fighting them or not fighting them. I think when we, after Shakti, after Kundalini's awaken us, the desire to fight them when they appear is a strong, immediately calls up, at least in my case, calls up allies and helpers that will see you through. I noticed the two when would have a vision of myself in meditation when I was stuck in some way. Like one was on a ship, on an old ship in the ocean, and we had run aground on a on rocks, still in the water, but couldn't get off it. So we rearranged the cannons and fired the cannons to knock us off the rock, and nothing had happened. And then his pure white butterfly comes along, just flitting along, very in the way the butterflies do. It's not in any rush, just seems to be. Ghost comes by, lands on one of the spars that's sticking out one side of the boat, side that's not on the rocks, lands for just a split second, just touches down, and the ship slips off into the water. And that kind of thing has happens. Those kind of visions in meditation happen to me very often when I was in trouble in some way. So it's just an interesting thing about demons. I remember seeing a, I don't know who did it, drawing or a portrait of Saint Francis being tormented. And some people say, well, look, he's insane, obviously, because he's got all these things ripping at his hair, demons and shit, and a naked woman looking horrifying in her aspect. And I thought, oh, yeah. And then later I realized that no, those are the aspects of his ego. He's being tempted by all these things that he desires. Or might desire. And it's the same thing, Jesus being tempted. I don't know how long, was it 40 days, 40 nights or something? It's always 40 days in the Bible, it seems. So that kind of thing, and the Buddha as well, when he's tempted. So I think it happens to all of us. There comes a time that I've heard anyway and read, when you get to a certain point of almost reaching, I guess what people call full enlightenment or self-awareness, full, the ego becomes quite strong and temptation happens again. You can become this and your ego drops away unless you need to use it. Or you can have all this worldly stuff because you've got the power. I wonder if that happens to everyone. I've heard of it happening. Some people fall, some people don't. Well, not sure I want to find out. Well, maybe I do. Anyhow, that's all I want to say about that. Sorry for
Oh,
dragging it out like that.
no, nothing to apologize for. Not at all. Thank you, Tom. Thank you.
Welcome.
Yeah, some very fascinating symbolic visitations from the animals. The lion reminds me of that the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, that type of feeling. I forgot what his name is.
No.
But also that book was also religious undertones or themes. Yeah, very, very interesting. Another here is also talking about entities and demons. Christian shares here, I experienced an evil entity 2 summers ago. I could feel it, but it was just beyond my vision. It was stronger at night, so dark, and exuded pressure and fear. Brent was nice enough to speak with me about it 2 summers ago. Brent, you told me to face it and not to run. I did that, and I told the presence who I was. I told it that I seek all that is good. Immediately, I felt the darkness release. The pressure was gone, and the gnawing fear left me. Remember who you are. Wow. That is an incredible example of the power of remembering who we are, right? Yeah. So during this phase, because there was a bit of a phase where I was having these encounters, I had this mantra, which was, I am the light, I am the light, I am the light, hoping that this mantra would sort of reverberate into my dream state if I was having these sort of nightmares, for example, or if I was having these sort of encounters, hoping that that ongoing mantra would somehow subconsciously emerge if and when I were to have encountered some dark presence like this. And it did emerge, right? So practicing when things are going well, smooth, remembering that you are the light helps you to remember when the challenges come. Let's hear from Tom.
One more thing. In meditation, I also became had the most traumatic incident when I relived being lost when I was like a little kid, like 3 years old, in a big city. And at that point in that meditation, I didn't receive any help. I had to, in fact, went on for months and months of this horrible anxiety, which Brent knows about and a few people know. I had to seek help from outside, not from within the community, but outside to with EMDR and hypnotherapy to overcome that. So it's hard to know what's going to cure you. It's really is
Right.
you could look outside and inside, do both, because what the hell? Just want to let people know that too, that it isn't always Kundalini herself who will pull you through, but she will put you in the hands of people who will.
Yeah, well said. Well said. Yeah, we don't go through this process in a vacuum, in a silo. Yes, we can receive guidance, support internally. We can support ourselves, of course. But there's times where I think we're invited to engage in a little bit of drama, if you will, with the outside world, making connections, turning to people for healing, teaching, support, friends, et cetera, et cetera. And this is what makes it exciting. I was listening to Gabor Mate a couple of days ago, and he was describing that often when we experience something really challenging in our life, what makes that experience a traumatic one is if we don't have support immediately after. If we're left alone, isolated to just whatever, sit with those feelings or avoid them, suppress them, etc., that is what creates traumatic imprint. If we were to go through something difficult, but immediately we have support, then it may not actually turn into something more of a long-term traumatic input imprint, if you will. So something to think about there as well, right? We're meant to support one another. Life is hard. Things that are challenging happen. We can get through it if we support one another. Of course, easier said than done. And of course, I wish we could go back and not be isolated after, going through difficult things like how Tom you were describing when you were a kid and whatnot.
Question, if anyone's heard of this, there was a drug that was around, I don't know, maybe 20 years ago, that was supposed to be used to get people through PTSD and through trauma. And not it, apparently it rewired the brain somehow that whatever trauma you were feeling was no longer felt as traumatic. It's kind of an interesting, it was just an experience. And nothing, it sort of took that away, like an aspirin takes away a headache. Now, maybe two aspirin. Someone, anybody ever heard of that? Whatever happened to those studies around that stuff? Because I would have found it to be very useful for some.
Yeah. Well, I'm actually taking a course with Gabor Mate and some others, I believe even Dick Schwartz, about psychedelic therapy and integration and whatnot. And they describe the effects of ibogaine, and some really some veterans that have been through a lot. They talk about having a treatment with ibogaine, and MRIs are showing significant changes in their brain, almost immediately, like within like a week. Their brains are literally changing. And this is on an MRI, and maybe that's what you're referring to. I'm not sure.
Oh no, I
Yeah.
is it became gain come from Africa or
Yes.
okay. Thank you.
So I think some of the retreats and whatnot are becoming more popular around that, but from what I've understood, I've been in touch with somebody that's intending to do a retreat or a treatment. I don't know what the word is, but it's like a very long, very intense trip. And even when listening to Gabor Mate, or others, I can't remember, but people describe it as being a very, very challenging experience. But seems very powerful.
My memory of what I read about Ibogaine was, again, as someone who was in, I don't remember the source, unfortunately, it was in Africa. It took Ibogaine and the deity, I guess speaking through the shaman, or said that one of you is going to die. And they did, they all participated. And one of them did die at the end. He came out of the Ibogaine experience feeling good and looking healthy, but then slowly, in a matter of a few hours, lost his vitality and died. So that's what I kind of wonder if it was the African stuff. Has anyone else ever heard of that?
Dying after a psychedelic trip, or
After Ibogaine, specifically.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure.
Okay.
I think it's a very intense trip.
I wonder, yeah, okay, thanks.
Thank you. Yeah, and it's not the only psychoactive substance that has the potential for trauma healing. Many of them do, psilocybin, MDMA, ayahuasca, for example. But of course, engaging in them with intention is key, right? Setting, doing the work afterwards as well, very, very important. But with that said, it seems like, yeah, there are some like almost like very profound healings that can take place. Like, for example, we were talking about on ibogaine and whatnot. But I'm sure there's still integration work that needs to be done, even in those cases. Let's hear from Monroe.
I'd like to say, as far as drugs are experienced, my own experience, I've done a few drugs, of course, is that they're peak experiences, and it's hard to maintain the information received because it's an overwhelming amount of information. I think it's better to do the work to scale up to that point, to scale to the peak. That way you can maintain that level of experience on a consistent basis. And as many gurus have said, and many spiritual leaders have said, when you do the work, it's easier to maintain the higher level of vibration, the higher frequency, because everything that comes at you, you realize it is only a reflection of your own psyche. People aren't actually attacking you, they have their own psyche that they're dealing with, and they're responding to their own projection, pretty much, of a problem. And if you are reacted or triggered by that, then there's something in you that is still unhealed as well. So going through the shadow work and going through the actual steps is probably more important than the peak experience. It can help with traumatic, with healing trauma, yes. But like you said, going back and going back through that trauma after you've healed and doing the work anyway, you get to maintain that experience. That's pretty much all I had to say.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you. Thank you, Monroe. No magic pills. Got to do the work, right? That's why many, many people, engage in psychedelic use, many, many people, right? But not all of them are, like Monroe was saying, operating at those peak experience levels in an ongoing manner. But those that I have encountered who seem to be operating at a very, very high level, they've done their work, their sober practices, if you will. Right. Thanks, Monroe. Red Pill Queen shares here. I'm wondering how many people have had interpersonal issues since having Kundalini. This seems to have wrecked most of my relationships. Yes, demon attacks, but from family and friends here, I've had to start over basically. Others are relating as well about the isolation, having to Reconsider letting them in. Christian shares here, I've learned to keep my experience with Kundalini to myself. My family, wife, and kids are very Christian, and the little I've shared has freaked them out. No one around me wants to know anything about spiritual experiences outside of biblical ones. And Christian got five thumbs up on that message. So definitely not alone. Lisa shares here, this is the first summer I was told to research Kundalini. And ever since finding more about it, mostly from this podcast series, so thank you. Along with my political class consciousness awakening over the past year, has me not being able to tolerate certain people who are not on similar alignment. Yeah, it seems to be somewhat of a universal theme, this period of isolation. The way that I've understood it is that we have to spend some time alone. So if we look traditionally, hermits, mystics, monks will take a vow of silence, nuns will take a vow of silence to impose isolation upon themselves, to retreat away from the world, to do this work without distraction. Fortunately for some, we are forced into retreat when others retreat from us. The end is the same. We are alone to do our work without distraction. Of course, when it happens against our will, by surprise, it hurts. It's confusing. It's very different than going consciously to a place where you're going to not say anything to anybody, or you're going to sit in a cave. Very different where you, when you've chosen it or when you haven't chosen it. But it seems that there has to be some period where we spend time alone. All the paths have engaged. All those that have walked the path have engaged in some degree of isolation and aloneness. Right? Look at any of the stories. So that doesn't necessarily make it any easier. But as we know, the hero's journey, and if we look at this model through the hero's journey, there is a return. There is a return phase back to the village, back to the known world, where we return with our awakening, our gifts, and reconnect. So this has been my experience. I hope the same for others as well. I hope that connection community is drawn back to you. The same force that took it away, life, Shakti, the universe, the flow, will bring them back to you in a new way. Maybe not the same people, but some people. For me, it's all of you. So I hope that for everyone.
Hey
Hey,
Brent,
Mark.
thanks. I really liked what you just shared. This is a great topic, maybe for next time or for another time, or if we have time now, but this has been on my mind, the isolation and any kind of reaching, like realizing that so much has been taken away and it's kind of like trying to reach back and trying to grasp onto it. I've noticed, especially with with apps online, it's so easy to be able to sign on to something, and then within your grasp, there's a bunch of possible connections. And yeah, I don't know. It's like too easy. It's too fast. It's like, especially if it's on your mind, like this isolation, and losing all of this, and something, the phone is in your hand. And it's like, okay, well, you can just reach for this right here, right now. Especially, anything related to dating, I would say that. That's a whole other topic, especially if your focus is there and you're going through this process. But like, we're all in this chat right now. And I mean, this doesn't feel isolating. This feels good. Like, it feels like all are welcome here. And this feels like a great, safe space to be in. And I'm just noticing, like, it's not black or white. It's for myself, like, feeling myself and feeling how wonderful Shakti feels and God and Gaia and just being connected to everything. And I don't have to share that with everybody. There was another group on here when I was experiencing this unconditional love. There's like this part of you. I was like, whoa, like people have to know, what I mean? People have to know what this is like. And then I was like, no, maybe not, maybe not that way. maybe in the right circumstance, maybe when that comes up, like that'll be time to share it. Like keep focusing on yourself and feeling that energy within, but not like in a, not like in a resistant, like, okay, you're not allowed near me, push away kind of way, more like in a focusing on myself. And if something comes up that feels balanced, without reaching right away or not reaching or pushing, then that's good, right? You'll feel it. So it's, yeah.
Beautiful. Yeah, thanks for being here with us, Mark, and to everyone else.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Oops.
I was thinking, this is a good theme. We can unpack it a little further. We can sit together in the grief, in the loneliness, but then I would also offer some empowering ideas and attitudes as well. Maybe we'll talk about that next week. What's the date next week? I can't remember what I've got going on. Yeah, I think we should be able to do it next week. We'll talk about the loneliness, the isolation, how to move through that a little bit. Okay. Yeah, thanks for making my job a little easier because it's I don't know what I'm talking about. Sometimes I just kind of see what comes up. So that's a good one. Tracy shares here, in the earliest stages of my awakening, before I knew what it was, as a Catholic, I would pray intensely with prayers of spiritual warfare. Later, I sought healing from a spiritual healer who may have helped me through dark forces. I had forgotten that I went through this phase, and I thank God I made it through successfully. Very interesting. Yeah. It seems that many of us have to go through a phase of some pretty intense darkness, whether it's obvious demonic dark forces, shadow beings, these types of things, or just some really heavy stuff in life. Seems like this is the initiation. Hopefully, we all make it through successfully. I believe that we will. Monroe shares here, the attacks come when we are already making an effort to expand our consciousness. The example Nick gave of Jesus being tempted was after 40 days of fasting and meditation in the desert. He was physically weak and thus vulnerable. This is also a test or challenge to maintain and integrate. For example, apply what we've learned into our way of living, thus truly gaining wisdom through our experience. Right. Vicky shares here, I used to think I want to take LSD as I was dying, like Timothy Leary did. But having been with two people as they died, with painkillers helping their pain, etc., I now feel so strongly that I want to experience the death transition completely, if it is possible. And I feel that with all of life. That's beautiful. Yeah. It's a transition. That's the key word there, the death transition, right? That change. There's some interesting material out of Tibetan Buddhism and some others about being a, like they broke down what the death experience is like and being able to anticipate the various changes that will come and staying present with it, staying present with it, staying alert with it, so you can die a conscious death. So there are some who practice, is it the art of dying? Preparing for that moment when it comes. Miss Medieval on YouTube shares here, can we have recurring Kundalini rising throughout life? For example, I had Kundalini rising that lasted from August to November 2023, and now I feel like it has begun again since October. Yes, definitely, definitely. So I refer to this as Kundalini process, more broadly even as just spiritual transformation process. Something like this. It's a process. It's an ongoing process. One time the image came to me, it's like a flower that just keeps blossoming. Like it doesn't stop. It just keeps blossoming, right? And so it's not like this one and done type thing. Sometimes people will describe a specific moment of energetic rising of an energetic explosion or an awakening experience that's very marked, very prominent on their journey. But you can have multiple experiences like that, all of a different nature, different theme, different flavor, different intensity. Some may never have those moments either. They may never have a clear, specific moment where energy bursted up the spine, and yet they're still in the ongoing process. Yeah. So I like to think about it as if it's like, can we go through puberty throughout life? Yeah, puberty ends when we become adults, but still the body goes through its changes even into adulthood, right? Body starts to change, hormones, all these different things. The change doesn't stop. It's the same with this process. Kundalini is impermanence, like we discussed. It is change. It is an ongoing process. It just never ends. And generally speaking, there seems to be trajectories towards more feelings of relaxation, calmness, steadiness, being able to slip into that flow of impermanence more regularly, feelings of oneness, right? The ability to process stress very quickly rather than accumulating it and holding on to it, for example. Those are some general trajectories, but the process just seems to continue. It seems to continue. It doesn't seem to end. Let's hear from Mark.
Hey, I want to share because I think we're talking about shadows. I've had different aspects of shadow coming up with Pluto going into Aquarius. So Pluto was in Capricorn before. I felt like I totally know what's going on, you know, and that everything kind of switched. There's been more like, it's been more social. Like Aquarius is more related to social aspects. And yeah, I just want to point that out for anybody if there's been like different shadows coming up for you. It's been helping me a lot to consider the sign of Aquarius and how that reflects to my experience. So.
Thanks, Mark. I know others here are into those themes. I don't know much about astrology and the zodiac and whatnot, but I see it as valid. See it as valid. There's some discussion here in the chat about the differences between Kundalini risings and Kundalini awakening. There's different ways of talking about it. For the example, the work of PKYC refers to the process as a rising process. I've referred to, while I'm in nowhere near the same league of PKYC, I've referred to a rising as a specific momentary experience. You know, when people describe this energy bursting up the spine, you know, that's a rising. Whereas PKYC, like I said, Patanjali Kundalini Yogacare, fantastic work. They refer to rising as a more ongoing process. So it's all language stuff. The awakening process, I like to see it's awakening. It's a verb. It's ongoing, right? It's ongoing. It's just a flower that keeps blossoming. So many different ways of looking at it. Some, of course, don't even use this language of Kundalini. They'll just refer to their spiritual awakening journey, right? Evolution of consciousness. Expansion of consciousness, spiritual process, whatever. So many ways to think about it. Lisa shares here, I'm enjoying this convo, bringing embodied astrology along with the Kundalini. I think there's a book that actually talks exactly about this. Astrology and Kundalini. Let me see what it's called. Astrology and the Rising of Kundalini, the Transformative Power of Saturn. Chiron, and Uranus. I have this book on my shelf, but I did not read it. Maybe some others are into it. Vicky shares here, I know there's a huge change of general energy with the change of sign for Pluto from Capricorn to Aquarius. Monroe shares, in my experience, there are as many paths to awakening as there are souls. It is very much a subjective experience, and that expands us into the objective or collective experience, right? Yeah. No two awakenings are the same. Not at all. I think that's like one of the most important things for people to understand very early on in the process so that they don't compare themselves to others, and get confused. It's different for everyone. Different for everyone. Lisa shares here, are there examples of Kundalini rising or awakening from profound grief or sadness? Certainly, there must be. I can only think of one example. I hesitate to speak his name, like Voldemort. And my mention of him is not an endorsement of his work. Osho, Rajneesh. If I remember correctly, he watched his grandfather die, and this sparked this question in him, which was, I want to find that which never dies. So perhaps that is a form of grief that led to his awakening. Just one example that's coming to me that I can think of. Longing, heartbreak, these types of things are certainly common. Any degree of suffering, essentially, right? Suffering. I can think more general, right? Those emotions causing a person to become a seeker, to become a seeker. But in terms of an awakening taking place during like a profound energetic rising or mystical experience happening during grief or sadness, I've never heard of that, but I'm certain it's possible. And I'm sure there's people out there that have been brought to significant shifts in consciousness as a result of profound grief. Yeah. Red Pill Queen shares here, two people I knew had it from shock. Lisa shares here, thank you so much. I'm trying to pin down my first times for sure after my mom passed. It's suffering that leads us to seek, right? Any form of suffering. Vicky as well shares here, for me, after my partner died, my Kundalini experience was very much reawakened. Seems any emotional intensity can be a doorway. EE shares, I think in this video, Tara S talks about a ghost experience. She talks about obviously not liking that she suggests asking, telling yourself what you don't want, goats, demons, etc., and what you do want, loving this. Loving this. Thanks, EE. Got the YouTube link there as well for those interested. Well, everyone, let's begin to wind down tonight. Thank you all so much. This has been a fantastic time to connect with you all. So much great contribution, support, shares. Thank you all so, so much. Really, really appreciate you all. We'll meet again next week. We'll talk about isolation, loneliness, support one another through that, see what comes out. Join us same time, same place, 9 p.m. Eastern next Sunday. Special thank you to Nick for sharing today about your book, Saffron Tiger. Check it out. Thank you all so much. You can look forward to a full conversation with Nick as well. To all those that have shared, offered support, appreciate you all. Appreciate you all. Thank you all so much. KundaliniAwareness.org. You can submit your story. You can find a licensed mental health professional with Kundalini experience to support you. Tomorrow, 2 p.m. Eastern, I'm hosting a Kundalini Q&A meeting. You can join us. We'll have some more conversations. Link is there, brentspirit.com/KundaliniQA. Links in the description, lots of free courses and things. Check it all out. I appreciate you all. Much love, everyone. Much love.